Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. This is Patricia Camilleri, inviting you to discover what research, projects and events are taking place at the University of Malta.
I'm very pleased to have with me in the studio today Dr. David C. Margry. Dr. Margry is a senior lecturer in the Department of Chemistry. Just a few words, a little biography of my guest. Dr. Margry graduated from the University of Western Ontario in London, Canada, with a BSc Honours and PhD in Chemistry in the area of Physical Organic Chemistry. He was a postdoctoral research fellow at Queen's University of Belfast in Northern Ireland. He returned to Canada as an assistant professor at the University of Prince Edward Island and subsequently held positions at the University of Ontario Institute of Technology and at Acadia University up to 2010. David then joined the University of Malta in September 2010 as senior lecturer in analytical chemistry. He's a leading expert in the field of luminescent sensing and molecular logic gates, with the distinction, I might say, of having the most cited paper in tetrahedron 2005-2008, which has been cited over 500 times, and that's pretty good. He is the author of numerous peer-reviewed publications, including three book chapters. His current research interests are the rational design and synthesis of novel luminescent molecular logic gates and nanomaterials, with useful functional capabilities that combine sensing, computing, and functionality for potential real-life applications. He's the local coordinator for Science in the House and associate editor of Scienza and Malta's representative on the COST action entitled Supramolecular Chemistry in Water, about which we shall be speaking today. Welcome to University
Matters. Thank you, Patricia.
This is another in our COST series of interviews through which we are looking at some of the fascinating projects that are being undertaken by many of our academics. And this one in particular, as I said, is the supramolecular chemistry in water. And I think probably we better start off with asking Dr. Margry to tell us what supramolecular chemistry in water really is.
Well, okay. Well, thank you very much for that gracious introduction. Well, supramolecular chemistry is a growing field in chemistry, which was given a Nobel Prize. The father is Jean-Marie Lem. Since then, this action is actually a result of his pioneering work. What it is, it's taking molecules together and often make sometimes small, sometimes bigger molecules, such that they come together as a group, as a unit, in order to often do some function. And this is very common in nature. Proteins are based on this, DNA structure, and even the concept of life itself is based on really assembly of molecules coming together that do some function.
And this COST action, what exactly were the main objectives of it?
There are at least three. The COST action itself, one deals from a biological point of view, just understanding how you assemble molecules together in an organized way. It's a term known as self-assembly. And then how you can take advantage of the thermodynamic stability, or how molecules come together on their own, to begin to do useful things with them, changing their states from one state to another, for many applications, from medicine, from environmental monitoring, medical diagnostics, for example. So a subgroup of that is actually trying to make molecules that can detect for things in the environment, say for different pollutants, whether they're heavy metals or whether they're drugs that have gotten into the water supply. Things that, for example, they get flushed down the toilet. They have to be filtered out. You want to make sure that they're not getting into the water supply. Things like gasoline additives, testing for explosives and gunpowder. So even from a security point of view, it has applications.
Before going into that side of it in a little bit more detail, the action itself involves quite a few people. And as we've heard before in this series, the money for COST doesn't actually go into your research itself, but it goes into the networking. And how long has this action been going, and what kind of networking and with whom have you managed to do so far?
Well, the action has been going on for 4 years now. There's one more year to go. So there are about 17 countries represented. It's actually a huge action. There's about 70 participants. We were very fortunate to have hosted the last conference here in Valletta in November, where we had 95% participants.
Oh, that's a huge number.
That's a big one for a cost, yes. The question is...
Who are they? I mean, where do they come from? Universities? Are they all European?
Yes, they're all European. Most of them are all academics, but like I said, pretty much from... much of Europe, but we also have representation from Turkey and Israel as well.
And do you find that they are studying different things? I mean, when you go and meet them at the network and you have your presentations and this sort of thing, are these chemists doing different things to what you're doing? How do you sort of divide the work? Do you have work packages for you and work packages for somebody else? And how does that dovetail together?
Well, actually, so... there's actually three working groups under the same umbrella of supramolecular chemistry and water. And from those three umbrellas, there's those that do molecular recognition, chemo, or making chemosensors. In other words, designing molecules that can detect for some species or species. The second working group is trying to control selectivity's term, or controlling the reaction that actually can occur in water so that you can actually control what product might form. And then there's the third group, which is about actually taking molecules, and then when you put them in water, they become an organized unit, and then using that unit to do some type of sensing or programming to get information. So some of it is very fundamental work, just trying to understand when you put soap together. Soap tends to form nice little round spheres. What happens at the surface of the soap with the water? We still don't really know a lot of what's going on. Very basic things like that you take for granted when you're washing your dishes.
Before going on air, you were sort of going into a little bit of detail. Obviously, I understand that listeners are not going to understand the sort of the detail of the chemistry, but talking about examples about, say, using these kind of methods with drug delivery, I think people would understand that kind of application to what you're doing.
Yes, one of the exciting themes within the cost is designing molecules that can actually... carry a drug, and so that when you take it orally or in the blood, it stays encapsulated within the molecule. But then when it gets to its target, where it needs to go, the right organ, something happens. Either there's a stimuli, something, either the pH changes, or there's an enzyme in the body that can then take away the capsule and then actually deliver the molecule. Now, some are even thinking cleverly how you can then actually have this drug carrier actually come back. And or salvage it. So kind of like the space shuttle Challenger. It flies out, does its mission, and you want to bring it back. You don't want to just lose it out in space.
Gosh, that sounds actually amazing, the idea of these things going into, I presume, the bloodstream and doing what they have to do. But what about the talk about the molecules itself, because I love hearing you talk about molecules, about which I know absolutely nothing, really, except the very, very basics. What do these molecules look like, and just how small are they?
Well, small, we're talking, actually, there's been a lot of buzz about nanotechnology. The thing is, chemists have been working at below nanotechnology. And actually, supramolecular chemistry is, once you start bringing about 5-6 molecules together, you're at the nano realm. So we're actually, in a sense, also nanotechnologists by bringing molecules together. So many of these molecules are some names that you might hear are things like cyclodextrins, cucurbiterols, colixirines, podins. These are all some terms. But what they are is they're molecules that may be shaped like a loop or like a cylinder or like a bowl. And so... you can actually have molecules will actually find their way into these, and they'll interact with the bowl such a way that they'll stay within it. And then you can then have this molecule, this bowl or hoop with this trapped species in it, And from that, you can do clever things with. That's the idea of this drug delivery. You put it in, and it stays stuck in there. But if the environment changes, then it comes out.
And you were saying that some of these shapes are better than others and more useful to you than others. A hoop is not as good as a ball shape or something cup-shaped or something like that.
Yes, it's molecules are dynamic. So if you have something in solution or in water, they're always moving. So if you can, it's always better if you can have a molecule that's shaped more like a bowl, because there's only one way it can go in and out. So it's slower to go in, but once it's in, it's more trapped. And even better is if you could have a lid, design a molecule that's like a bowl, and then have the lid, and with some stimuli, it actually traps it.
In my total ignorance, I thought molecules were molecules that had the same shape. I mean, why have they got different shapes? Do we know? Is there a purpose behind their shape?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. Is there a purpose? That's actually something we're thinking hard about. We often know there are certain shapes, and it goes back to the periodic table and the fundamentals of the sizes of the atoms and the radii, which actually allow certain shapes. And then once you start getting into organic chemistry and the carbon, it's known actually there are specific geometries that certain atoms bind in, and so that begins to actually dictate the shape that these molecules just tend to take.
Another area which I think people will be very interested to hear about is the way this might help to work within polluted areas. What kind of work has been going on in that area, trying to help with the pollution, with the environmental problems?
One of the areas that's going on is just trying to use these bowl-like structures to actually encapsulate heavy metal toxic waste. You hear a lot in China about electronic debris and heavy metals like chromium, for example. But even old problems like lead, because we used to have the lead gasoline, mercury, these are often in the soil and in the water supply. So making molecules that can actually trap these so that we can take them out of the water so we can have safe drinking water, for example. Another example is a strategy for dealing with nuclear reactive waste. What do you do with all that waste that's still in Chernobyl and other places? There's a lot of waste. What do you do with it? So one way is to try to trap it within molecules. And then, of course, then we have the issue of what do you do with that then? Often then it's stored somewhere underground in a cavity.
But presumably it would be safer if it were treated in this sort of way, with a molecule, being trapped in a molecule, than it is at the moment, where it's just buried as it is.
Yes, because if you know it's in the molecule, then you know at least it's trapped, it's not going to leach away. So a chemist could actually design it, and what they'll do is actually measure the binding constant. So how strong does it bind? And be able to predict, by experimentally and computationally, how long it should stay there, even from point of view. Yeah.
What about nowadays? We know that they say that in London, 9 people, when you drink a glass of water, it's already been down the throats of 9 people before it went down yours, obviously if they've got it out of the tap. So presumably there is that kind of cleansing idea already where used water is chemically cleaned. How does this differ from that? What is already being done?
Well, right now we often add chemical additives, and they're more there to deal with killing bacteria. But we do have filters. So charcoal is a common filter when you buy a Breta filter, and that's actually what you're doing. You're using charcoal. So there you have a phenomenon of absorption, where things stick to it. But we don't often know the structure of the charcoal very well. But you could easily replace them with these superconductor systems that are porous. And so you could actually, so often it's organic ligands or molecules, small organic molecules, or even heavy metals, because that's often why the water doesn't taste well. Too much calcium in our water, for example, or sodium makes it salty or makes it taste chalky. So actually trapping this. Now again, a theme is the idea of making smart filters. So again, not only do you trap it and you have to throw away the filter, but what if you can then take the filter, somehow change it using light or acidity or something, so that then it can release it and then you can reuse the filter. Now that's kind of the long term. Now, businesses don't like that. They like the idea of you use it once.
Consumables.
Yes, consumables. where others are thinking about how you can make things, you know, last longer and be more economically friendly and socially friendly. Right?
What about your studies over the years? I'm fascinated by your ITER, the where you started off from and sort of how you've moved through the chemistry area. When you started off as a chemist, was it always your great love, chemistry? Were you one of those little boys that had chemistry sets when they were small, or did it come to you later in life?
No, I always had fascination for chemistry. The chemistry set was more the kitchen, you know, finding the baking soda and the vinegar and whatever else you could find in the kitchen. That's how it started. Actually, my interest was to go into mathematics. I had a real love for mathematics, really had a good foundation for it. Chemistry is something that I discovered in high school, in a sense. And then had all intentions to go do mathematics, and then it happened that by going to the University of Western Ontario, we have a general science first year. And so I found that I didn't really have a preferred direction. So I took chemistry because it was middle of the row. It still let me use the mathematics, the physics, and the biology, and chemistry put me right in the center of it, of science.
It's one of the things I've sort of discovered here at university, having really not been interested particularly in chemistry before, but I've spoken to several chemists. I've spoken to Professor Alfred Vernon, and hearing the chemists speak, I must say, it really is a fascinating area, and I wish that I'd taken more notice of what was going on in my chemistry classes. Mm. Going back to your work, you have a project which isn't directly concerned with this cost action, but which is, I know, close to your heart, and it has a lovely name. It's called Lab on a Molecule. Tell us about that. How did that start off, and sort of where did that lead?
Well, the Lab on a Molecule concept results from my postdoctoral work in Belfast with Professor A. Prasanna De Silva, who's actually a leading expert in molecular computation. I was really fascinated with what he was doing, and that's where I chose. I wanted to go off to Belfast. During my postdoc, we actually designed a molecule, or molecular engineered. So I spent the time in the lab to make a molecule that had three receptors. In other words, it had a crown ether, which actually binds through non-covalent interactions, supramolecular chemistry, to sodium. And we had another group, an amino phenyl diacetate, which binds for zinc. And then we had another area that detects for protons. So we had a molecule that could detect for three things, sodium, protons, and zinc. And each one only fit in its specific place. This idea of, I was talking about bowls and having cylinders and having molecules fit in the same place. And then we also, within the molecule, designed a fluorophore, which is a molecule that if you shine light on it, gives off a different color of a light. So the molecule works by detecting a congregation. So we even played up the idea of two's company, three's a crowd. So the molecule detects for a crowd of species. And when it detects all three species, the molecule glows bright and tells you that you've got these three things. And the Lab on Molecule came about because we thought about how could you use this? And we thought, well, this could be a new way of detecting for disease. Because right now, when you go to, say, for example, do a blood test, they'll do specific tests for specific things. So they'll do one test for your sodium levels, one test for your cholesterol, one for, say, a protein. This was the idea of a general method. If you know a certain disease, like kidney disease, for example, because you know, if your kidneys are not doing well, your sodium levels go up, your potassium levels goes up, and even the acidity goes up. You could have a way of actually diagnosing for disease directly just using molecules.
Gosh, that sounds a very useful way. Dare I ask how it's done? I mean, this is microscope work. I mean, how do you create a molecule like that? I mean, it's mind-blowing, really.
Well, a lot of thought. So we use a system. The idea is the receptors are actually designed such that they're attached to the fluorophore, but not directly. So we kind of have the fluorophore, and it's not the same, but you connect them to the fluorophore. The analogy is like having a light bulb with a wire to a switch. And every time that you detect one of the species, it's like flipping a switch. So it's a molecule where you flip three switches, the light goes on. But if one of the switches is not flipped on, it's still off. So that's the general premise. So actually in the lab, we work with chemicals in solution, and we have techniques to purify them. And I guess big achievement is we use a technique known as nuclear magnetic resonance, which is similar in technology to MRI, where you're actually looking at molecules in a solution. And from that, we can actually get detailed information about the structure of molecules. So that was actually, I still remember that day when I came in, I said, I think we got it. And Professor De Silva actually stopped what he was doing and sat down. I think we spent an hour just going through. He just wanted, and I don't think he even wanted me to do any work for 2 weeks. He actually just sat back and left the spectra there on his desk just to admire it every time he came in the morning.
Lovely, so, eureka moment.
So, yeah, that was just the making it. So then we had to test it. And then,
and how did you do that?
Yes, to test it, we used fluorescent spectroscopy. So fluorescence is a technique, or fluorescence is a phenomenon, I should say, where certain molecules, particularly if they're rigid, when you shine light on them, molecules can do certain things with that energy when you excite them. If they're rigid, they tend to just give it off as light. But other molecules that are kind of floppy or wiggly would give them off by vibrating. So part of it is knowing the structure of the molecule. And so you can actually use an instrument known as a fluorimeter that actually we can measure this. But you can see a lot of this with your own eyes. You can shine light on the molecule and see a glow. Now, actually, many people do not realize that they are exposed to fluorescence every day. For example, tonic water has quinine, which was added as an anti-malarial agent. But actually, if you put UV light on it, you'll see that it glows blue, because the quinine has a chromophore in it, or fluorophore in it, that actually gives off light. Another one is coumarin, which is used in baking, baking and even cooking. And so often you see many dishes where you seem to have a glowing yellow spice. That's actually because coumarin is fluorescent.
Never crossed my mind. I shall look at it with new respect. And I'm not quite sure I want to have another tonic water, actually, after that. So have you got as far as actually applying this, or are the applications still in theory?
You mean the lab on the molecule concept?
Yes.
Well, that's the first one. The big leap, too, was that we actually showed it with soluble in the water. So it's actually a lovely example of what we're trying to do through the cost action, making molecules that can detect for things and that are stimuli responsive, so it is response to these cations, and to give a function. And so the idea of medical diagnostics. We've just published a paper right now in ChemCom where we've added a twist to it, where we actually detect for sodium, protons, and iron. But the mechanism how we detect for iron, so iron-3 in particular, is different. Rather than binding, we actually take advantage of an electron transfer process. So we treat the iron as an oxidant rather than as an analyte. That's what we chemists say. And why that's interesting is that iron is actually not so easy, iron-3 in particular, is not so easy to detect for. Mm-hmm. It tends to quench the fluorescence of fluorophores, where in order to have this concept of detection, you like things to turn on. Iron turns most of them off. So we came up with this strategy of detecting for iron by doing this oxidation chemistry as well as the binding. And again, this could be important for certain cancers, because colorectal cancer and liver cancers are thought that when the levels of sodium, protons, and iron are high, that might be enough to trigger cancer. Iron is also important from the point of view of just blood itself. High blood and disorders when the iron levels get high in your blood. And, of course, so is sodium, and the pH is important. So whenever you have when you do have a medical condition, it's normally not just because one thing is not right. As soon as one thing's not right, the body adjusts. Something else then adjusts. And so often many things change as a result of something when you're not being well. So when you're sick, it's not just because one thing has changed. As a result, then many things change. So it might be, a strategy for detecting. We propose it maybe for cancer. But the strategy might also be useful just for environmental sensing. Because in the paper, we wrote a little bit about how maybe we could use these molecules for detecting corrosion, for example.
Which is?
Rust, you know.
Oh, rust.
Rust. What if you could put molecules on the edge of the car, and if you see the car starting to glow, it's beginning to rust. I mean, we're still away from that, but that was, you know, kind of the idea.
Sounds excellent. What about how the cost is going on now? You say, are you almost at the end, or are there still some meetings to happen?
Well, our next meeting for next year is planned in Prague. Probably November traditionally is when we've had the meeting. And then there will be probably another 6 months after that. So we'll probably have another year and a half to go. It's been very successful, a number of publications, a lot of collaborations. We've been fortunate enough to collaborate. Two of my grad students are off abroad right now at this moment. One is in Slovenia at the NMR Institute, where we're doing studies on some colorimetric sensors, we call them, molecules that they detect species by changing color. So we're seeing purples and blues, for example. And then I have another student in Zabrek in Croatia right now. So they're both away for about 3 to 4 weeks. And I get the odd email from them, but I think they're having so much fun right now.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. When they don't write, it means they're enjoying themselves. Well, that sounds absolutely fascinating. And what is the deliverable at the end of the day? Is there going to have to be some report, or, you know, what is that going to be?
Yes, well, yes, there's the annual meeting where the chair has to go. So we all contribute to pitch in. This is how we've contributed through publications and through the workshops. There's a special issue that is being planned, so that we'll all have in a scientific journal by the Royal Society of Chemistry, where the idea is every group will try to contribute a publication to commemorate the action, for example. And you never know, sometimes then there's even the idea of even a book to come out of the work. Now, that hasn't been planned, but I know the special issue has been talked about at the last management meeting.
And these collaborations and connections and networks, I mean, they won't be severed at the end of the cost action. You'll be able to go on taking advantage of them, you and your doctoral students as well, later on, after it's finished, I suppose.
Yes, no, that's actually the strength of it. You're actually meeting the experts in the field, and Europe has a lot of them. We actually are. The idea is to give Europe kind of a competitive edge. It's kind of the idea by bringing together expertise and then pooling it together to even do more with it.
Well, we'll come to the end of our time. Thank you very, very much, Dr. David Margry, for coming to talk to us about this COST project, which is entitled Supramolecular Chemistry in Water. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed myself.
Thank you for listening to University Matters on Campus FM. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.